This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiswu Heeb, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The campaigns are over. Candidate Boakai and candidate Weah now await the verdict of the Liberian voter, as do other presidential hopefuls like veteran lawyer and politician Charles Bromstein or former Coca-Cola executive Alexander Cummings.
That's Bram Postumus reporting from Monrovia on tomorrow's national election. Details next.
Also, at least 8 migrants are dead after a Tunisian ship collided with a boat carrying 70 migrants. And opposition supporters rallied across Kenya today demanding reform to the Electoral Commission before elections.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Liberia heads to the polls tomorrow to choose a successor for President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who is stepping down at the end of her second term. 20 candidates are vying to replace her, including her own vice president and a former soccer star who has run against Sirleaf twice before. Bram Postumus reports from Monrovia.
This is the ruling Unity Party campaign song, and the message could not be more emphatic. There can only be one winner in Tuesday's elections, and that's us. At party headquarters, supporter Rosa Laba is clear.
Ali will need somebody that will be able to take where she took it from to continue.
The she Laba refers to is President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and who better to continue in the president's footsteps than her longtime number two. Vice President Joseph Boakai has a solid reputation, reserved, modest, and he's never been accused of corruption. But not everyone is sold on a Boakai presidency.
I wouldn't love to see a continuity in another sense. The party has served us for 12 years, so there's a time for change now.
Change. The word zooms around opposition candidate George Weah's enormous campaign headquarters. Weah has run for president before. The international soccer legend and senator from Monserrado is hoping to make it third time lucky. Cecilia Moi sums up the mood.
I voted for him because tomorrow he will do something good for Liberia.
And what that good is, well, that's pretty much the same whoever you talk to. Liberia needs to restore its dilapidated public health sector. That shortcoming was badly exposed by the Ebola epidemic that officially ended in Liberia just over a year ago. Liberia needs quality education, not in evidence today, according to many here. And the old refrain, Liberia badly needs roads, especially in the interior, where once again the National Electoral Commission struggled to get ballot materials to all the isolated corners of the country. The campaigns are over. Candidate Boakai and candidate Weah now await the verdict of the Liberian voter, as do other presidential hopefuls like veteran lawyer and politician Charles Bromstein or former Coca-Cola executive Alexander Cummings. Liberian voters have one quiet day to ponder their options as rains once again pummel this country and its capital. Provisional results could come later this week. Liberia's National Election Commission has until October the 25th to announce the final results. If no presidential candidate wins a clear majority, a runoff will be held. Bram Postumus for VOA News, Monrovia.
As reported, tomorrow Liberians will vote to elect their parliamentary representatives and the candidate they hope will succeed Ellen Johnson Sirleaf for president. If the two-round process is peaceful and orderly, it will be the first time in modern history that a duly elected Liberian president passes power to a successor freely chosen by the Liberian people and not put in place through corrupt practices or a coup. To find out more about this milestone and what it means both for Liberian democracy and for Liberian-American relations, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Ambassador John Campbell. Campbell is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. He's a former diplomat and the author of many books about the continent.
If the elections go well, what they will do is reinforce Liberia's return to democracy. And Liberia's return to democracy reinforces the very positive trend toward electoral democracy that we see right across the African continent.
Why would this represent a return? Because there's a handoff of an elected official to another elected official? Is that the acid test in your view?
That is the acid test, the handoff, but the handoff by means of credible elections. In other words, not rigged elections, not military intervention.
What would you say is Sirleaf's legacy, both perceived within Liberia and perhaps, if it's different, within the United States, especially in policy circles?
In the United States, she is extremely popular. Part of that is a reflection of a warm and winning personality. And she has worked very hard for really good bilateral relations. In Liberia itself, she is somewhat less popular. I suppose there's nothing particularly surprising about that. Political leaders are often less popular in their own country than they are abroad. She has been involved in Liberian politics for a very long time. And as such, she has been in situations that obviously can attract domestic criticism.
Are you thinking particularly of her response to the Ebola and also the economic restructuring that she promised that many Liberians seem to be complaining never really arrived for them on the ground?
But of course, economic restructuring in a country that has had almost a generation of civil war and under the best of circumstances is poor, economic restructuring is very difficult. With respect to Ebola, the international world health machinery, if you like, was clearly incapable of responding to the Ebola crisis in West Africa generally. I would note in passing that the United States, and particularly the U.S. Africa Command, played a highly positive role in the establishment of field hospitals and other types of assistance.
Now, as far as this election itself, where do we go from here?
The Liberian electoral system is rather interesting. For the presidency, it's a two-stage process. In other words, you will have the 20 or so serious candidates running against each other in the first round, but the second round will be between the two highest vote getters.
Do you have any idea about who they might be and what their differences might be?
I tend to think it will be Joseph Boakai, who's currently the vice president of the country and the candidate of the governing party. The other, I expect, will be George Weah. He was a soccer player. He ran against Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and he did surprisingly well. He's a person with good name recognition, and there are certain advantages to being a soccer player in African politics. I don't see any significant difference between the two candidates. There's an important point here. The elections do not reflect important policy differences amongst the candidates. The elections are driven by personality and to a certain extent by character, not by policy. My hope is that the elections are credible and peaceful, and that will reinforce the democratic trajectory in Africa, but they could go bad.
That was Ambassador John Campbell, Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
Italian media report at least 8 migrants are dead after a Tunisian ship collided with a boat carrying 70 migrants. The Italian Navy and Coast Guard were involved in the rescue after the boat sank. I spoke with reporter Josephine McKenna, who has details on the latest boat tragedy in the Mediterranean, as well as other migrant developments.
Yes, at least 8 people are feared to have drowned after a Tunisian ship collided with a migrant boat heading towards Italy early on Monday. The collision happened in the middle of the night southwest of the Italian island of Lampedusa. Now, the migrant boat is believed to have left Tunisia and was heading towards Sicily, the island of Sicily, with around 70 migrants on board. Now, about 40, I understand, have been rescued, but there are at least 20 or more unaccounted for. This could be a potential tragedy here with these people that are still missing.
I understand that the Italian Navy and Coast Guard were involved in the rescue of these migrants.
Yes, rescue vessels from the Italian Navy, the Italian Coast Guard, and from Malta have been dispatched to the area. And we don't know how this accident occurred. Of course, it was very dark. It happened in the middle of the night. But that, of course, made the rescue effort even more difficult and more dangerous. Vessels have been dispatched to the area, and we're waiting for an update on what's happened with those missing people.
How many migrants do you all know for sure are dead?
Well, that's the thing that's unclear, but at least 40 have been rescued, but there are still dozens that are unaccounted for.
Also, I understand that the Italian government, they are looking to overhaul some of the migrant centers. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, the Italian government has been pushing to shut down the flow of migrants from countries like Libya across the Mediterranean. And part of this plan is to also shut down large migrant centres and decentralise some of the migrants that have come to Italy, move them to smaller centres that will help with what the government hopes will be better integration and also the expulsion of migrants that the Italians don't feel have a right to remain in Italy. So this is, again, an indication of the much harder line that the Italian government is taking, led by the Interior Minister Marco Minniti. His move to really accelerate repatriation and his objective is to close these larger centres and also try and manage them in a more effective way to enable migrants to be better integrated in the community.
What has the flow of migrants been like so far this year in comparison to last year this time?
Well, as we've discussed in the past, the numbers have fallen dramatically since the middle of the year when the Italian government did a deal effectively with the Libyan Coast Guard to block that flow of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa coming up through Libya into the boats and crossing the Mediterranean. Now, the numbers for this year, the total number of arrivals since the beginning of January is 140,000, just above that number, and that's down 25% for the same period last year. Now, most of those migrants have come from Nigeria, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Mali, and the Sudan regions. But for now, it seems that the government is holding firm. And that's why we're also seeing an increase in the number of boats coming from Tunisia and Algeria trying to cross the Mediterranean and move migrants either through Italy or through Spain and other countries across the Mediterranean.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Hayes Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Liberians head to the polls tomorrow to choose a successor for President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And at least 8 migrants are dead after a Tunisian ship collided with a boat carrying 70 migrants. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Ugandan militants have attacked a Democratic Republic of Congo military base, killing UN peacekeeper and wounding a dozen more, according to the UN mission MONUSCO and the Congo Army. DC Army spokesman Mark Hazuke said he thinks the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, a Ugandan Islamist group, active near the border between Congo and Uganda, is responsible for the assault today. Reuters reports the group is thought to have ambushed and killed many civilians nearby this weekend. The spokeswoman for the UN's Congo mission, Florence Marshall, has also confirmed an attack took place this morning on the MONUSCO base. However, the nationalities of the dead and wounded were not immediately known.
The Kenya National Commission on Human Rights has accused the country's security agencies of killing more than 30 people after the August 8th poll. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
The government-funded rights group published a report Monday titled Mirage at Dusk, which documents human rights violations. According to the commission, 34 people, including a six-month-old baby, were killed by police during the 3 days of chaos. Another 3 people were killed in clashes between civilians. Commission on Human Rights member Jadida Warihu says the protests were triggered by the Electoral Commission's announcement that the incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta had defeated opposition leader Raila Odinga.
There was uproar in some of the areas in the country to protest that declaration. And we had protests in Nairobi, especially in the informal settlement areas like Mathare, Dandora, Kibera, among others. We had immediate protests also in Kisumu. Unfortunately, in the protests and the days after that, we had many Kenyans injured, and also we had a number of deaths. As in our record to date, we have 37 Kenyans who lost their life because of the skirmishes.
Interior Ministry spokesman Wenden Joka disagrees with the commission's findings.
The deaths that could be directly connected to the riots were less than 10. But for the Kenya National Human Rights to come and say that 7 people were killed by police, it's a highly exaggerated report. But they should also have provided names and the places of these people and the specific information showing when and where they died and the cause of death.
Waruhu says the number could be more because many are afraid to speak out about police abuses.
Each case is verified by us in terms of us going down, taking individual statements of those injured or from the family members of the deceased. So the cases we have are really verified. We had more reports than those, but a number we could not verify. And I don't also think that we have all the reports because there was a lot of fear of intimidation thereafter.
Tensions are still running high in Kenya as the country prepares for a rerun of the presidential election. The Supreme Court nullified the results of the August 8th vote, citing irregularities on the part of the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. The new election is scheduled for October 26th. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The South African government says it will introduce more effective antiretroviral or ARV drugs next year. The country has the highest ARV program in the world, giving the life-prolonging medicines to about 4 million HIV-infected people every month. UNAIDS says South Africa also has the biggest HIV epidemic in the world, with 7.5 million people living with the virus. Darren Taylor reports.
One of South Africa's leading HIV scientists, Professor Francois Venter, describes the new ARV drug, dolutegravir, as a big step forward.
The drug's much safer than the drug it's replacing. And just to top it all off, it's cheaper and it's much smaller.
Its size means it's easier for patients to swallow, so they're less likely to stop taking their medicine and to develop AIDS-related illnesses that may kill them. Fenter says some patients using the drug that dolutegravir is set to replace suffered negative side effects.
It was dizziness and almost feels like you were drunk. The first few days you start therapy, it messes with your sleep a bit, with your dreaming. A sizable number of patients just had some concentration problems. We've also described very rare but very serious liver and brain problems with the drug. All those side effects are a lot better on this new drug, dolutegravir. It's not flawless, there's no such thing. Its major side effect is actually insomnia.
If HIV-infected people on treatment stop taking their ARVs, they can develop resistance to them. The pills won't work, and the patients could become sick and even die. But Fenter says only a single case of resistance to dolutegravir has been reported among 700,000 users around the world over the past few years. At the moment, South Africa is paying $120 a year to keep each patient on ARVs. Fenter says thanks to support from the Clinton Health Access Initiative and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dolutegravir will be much cheaper than this.
The price guarantee at the moment starts at $75. We're hoping it'll come down a bit further than that. So when you're talking about 4 million people being on treatment, that's a big saving.
With the use of the improved drug, South Africa's health ministry expects to save $900 million over the next 6 years. It says it'll use this money to give dolutegravir to the 3.5 million HIV-infected people who are currently not on any treatment and are therefore at risk of death. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
A Sudanese human rights lawyer and spokesperson for the opposition Communist Party in Sudan says the lifting of U.S. sanctions on his country will have little impact on the lives of ordinary Sudanese unless there's total peace across the country and corrupt government officials are punished. Nabil Biagio has more from Nairobi.
Saleh Mahmoud says the lifting of U.S. sanctions on Sudan will have great benefits for the government and Sudanese businessmen with close ties to the government. But he says it's not clear whether ordinary people in Sudan will reap the benefit.
Lifting is benefiting a sector that is very much related to the business and status of officials, the government. They will benefit from it, definitely. But it will never immediately change the lives of the citizens.
In order to relieve the suffering of ordinary Sudanese, the government must make sweeping changes in its policies and fight systematic corruption.
The crisis has a political dimension. It's not only economic, which elements very much affecting the lives of the people. The number one element is corruption itself.
Mahmoud says, above all, the government needs to end the wars in Darfur, South Kordofan and Blue Nile states, which he says are draining the national budget and perpetuating human rights violations against civilians.
Unless war is stopped in Darfur, Blue Nile and South Kordofan, I think human rights situation will never improve because it is always war crimes against humanity and still we have the pending genocide of Darfur.
Khartoum-based political commentator Ismail Ibrahim agrees.
That is the most important thing, that you need to end the war, whether in Blue Nile or in Southern Kordofan or in Darfur. You know, you need a comprehensive political dialogue where you can get on board all the opposition.
Ibrahim says the lifting of U.S. sanctions creates a conducive environment for the government to move the country in the right direction. But Ibrahim says unless the government of President Omar al-Bashir stops the wars and carries out significant political reforms, the lifting of sanctions will not benefit ordinary Sudanese.
It depends on the government's willingness and ability to formulate and execute sound policies, particularly in the area of good governance, you know, where you have accountability, you have transparency, you have a new combating of corruption.
Ibrahim says the government must also allow more political and civil freedoms in the country. Despite the lifting of decades-long sanctions on Sudan, the country still remains on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. President Bashir was indicted years ago by the International Criminal Court on charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity said to be committed during the fighting in the Darfur region. He has yet to face those charges in The Hague. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.